Exit number 14208, reel 3.
Sergei Saganov, reel 3. Yes, we're now in this sort of Gorbachev period, and you're telling me about your journalistic rise.
It was not. I would not refer to rise. I would say it was. Americans like to use term self-realization. I kind of like it too, because it's a little bit self-descriptive. It's also a little bit blurred. So that's what happened with me, I believe. I started to work in journalism, or let's say in publishing, in 1986, I think I had a unique experience of eyewitnessing the change in the Russian self-expression, if you would dare to define press or media generally as a vehicle for self-expression. I started in the media, which was still very close, still very paranoid of the of being politically incorrect to those who were, like we'd say in Russia, ordering champagne up in the Communist Party ranks. I came to the publishing house where everything was very strict. There was a system of no censorship, but much rather self-censorship, where everybody was trying to do the right move, to make the right move, not to instigate any or cause any criticism from above. Therefore, there were a number of journalists sort of probing the limits of the allowed, but at the same time they were trying to be rather inconspicuous. There were other people who were trying to pose certain obstacles on the ways of those who were trying the limits. In many ways, they were successful. On the other hand, they also understood the peculiarity of the moment, and here and there giving rest to their to their defensiveness. So some of the really bold and audacious articles were published, and new brochures were introduced by the publishing house. So we felt more and more sort of like choking with freedom. It's like you are allowed to do something, you don't know exactly what. You're extremely excited about writing about sort of forbidden things, but you still don't know what is to what extent you should go. So it was a very exciting time. It was like trying to find whether your finger is still numb or not. For many journalists, it was a time their career booster. I was not one of them. I was very obedient. I was not trying to create something something untraditional, and I was certainly was taught by all my experience to wait certain period of time before allowing myself to do anything untraditional generally. The reason for that was very simple. I worked in a very different publication, a very different agency, rather than my fellow colleagues as journalists. I worked for a almost a propaganda agency, which published everything from brochures to articles, and had its own video and radio production, which was doing nothing but propping up the regime and helping Soviet foreign policy to be more effective, outside in the world. So,
what was it called?
The agency was called Novosti, and it still exists around the world. It's a very it was a very effective tool of Soviet propaganda. The offices of Novosti was proliferated throughout the country and outside. What there is else to say?
It was interesting when you mentioned Gorbachev earlier, mm-hmm. rather negatively, I thought. You know, mm-hmm. the fact that Glasnost was perhaps the only good thing he did. Could you elaborate on that? You know, and because here was all this sort of opening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why you said that about what your view of Gorbachev was really.
Believe that Gorbachev was the person who was pushed by the circumstances and the situation in the country to introduce certain amount of reform, but not all the reform. I strongly believe that that Gorbachev understood that this is going to be either revolution or chaos, and chaos, or a quite smooth transition into some sort of a new communist era. I never believed and would never be convinced by anybody that Gorbachev is a person who sincerely wanted new Soviet Union, wanted to see depolitization of the country and dismantling of the communist regime. I'm a staunch believer that Gorbachev was blood of the Communist Party. He was simply brought up by all those skeletons out of the closet to save the Communist Party, save its image, save its body, save its stability. And he was the person who was generally recognized to be subtle enough to communicate it to the nation. And I'm sure that his ability of smooth talking was pretty much noticed by all the members of the Politburo when they voted him in into the General Secretary's seat. Another thing is very obvious to me that there were certain things which intelligentsia knew and the country didn't know when Gorbachev came to power. Many of the, I don't think that even Western media knows, and as well as Russian media knew very much about the riots happening in Siberia or hardships and different strifes, the different problems the Russian population had in different parts of the country. Very worrisome signals which were reaching Communist Party headquarters, and they couldn't ignore them anymore. They knew they should have taken some measures, and Gorbachev was a very suitable solution for them, for everybody. So this person moved in, and as soon as the first doors were open, he understood that, first of all, I understood that he wouldn't be able to talk with the people and explain them that there's a new sort of a communist era which came just came along with him without media. And since he needed media to communicate to people, he was forced to go into this glasnost campaign, which of course was very limited, explaining why, for example, I was not extremely free and was not extremely encouraged to go ahead and express my views and whatever stuff I was writing or my colleagues were writing, or even in the ways of editing materials of other people. Therefore, I believe we're talking about Gorbachev, who was just trying to just trying to disguise the real intentions of his colleagues in the Communist Party. And he should be given credit for the Glasnost campaign, but he should not be given credit for neither one of those reform moves he made. The other thing is, I'm very certain that, and was certain at that time, that Gorbachev was indeed a person of no principles, the person who was just trying to survive, and a person with no particular political vision, which only turned to be true in 1991, when he almost became one of those plotters during the coup d'etat.
How about his record, though, with the disarmament? You know, how was that rated, do you think, in the Soviet Union?
I think it was viewed very positively. I believe, indeed, people were excited to see the changes in a relationship with the U.S. and the West. I don't think that the West should overestimate it, though, or overrate it, the importance of those meetings. Needless to say, I mean, it is very obvious that indeed the West was very interested in that, and the citizens and generally people in all the countries of the West were very scared of Russians, and which was in many ways the problem of having an intensive propaganda from Western governments as well. It was not just Russians feeding people with propaganda. There were Western countries as well. But I believe that the impact of those meetings were not very significant in Russia. I strongly believe that Russians were never afraid of the Western nuclear threat. I dare to say that because maybe I am wrong, and wrong for the reason that I maybe lived quite a while outside of the country, whereas maybe some of my compatriots have a very different feeling about it. On the other hand, I dare to say that simply for the reason that, again, Russians were taught to hate the governments, not the people. And there were not a lot of movies or documentaries or all kinds of media productions which were picturing the Western threat. There was no proliferation similar to the U.S. of those movies like Red Dawn or Russians Are Coming or whatever. There were no such kind of things. There were plenty of shows and talk shows about the threat of the U.S. and submarines and cruisers and fleets and God knows what, but somehow they were not material. They were all contemplative, if you wish. They were just something which you cannot touch or you cannot see directly. Whereas in the West, all those things were brought much closer to the audiences, and were allowed to touch, to see, to feel. There were a lot of paranoia. Russian audience, again, was a very close one. And it is very easy to convince your fellow citizens that the threat of the nuclear weapons in the West is not significant, and that the communist government in the Soviet Union is much stronger, since we have much more nuclear weapons and will retaliate at any time needed and stuff like that. So it's always a feeling of, first of all, which Russians always like to have, a feeling of sort of a national pride and national dominance over the world. So I don't think that Russians felt like they're insecure because Americans were there with nukes. I think that Russians felt they have enough nukes to confront American nukes. That was the idea. In the U.S., it was quite different because people were brought up to think independently, and each person thought individually within himself. And his particular idea was, well, what if somebody over there will push the wrong button? So the idea of that sort never was seen in Russia, in my view. So it was very different.
Do you think, in the light of what you've been saying about Gorbachev, that the West misperceived him?
I'm quite sure that the West misperceived him. On the other hand, and don't take it as a confusion, I guess the West perceived him right. The West perceived him right in seeing him as a peacemaker. He was a peacemaker, but he was forced to be a peacemaker because the enormous arsenals of different armaments, starting with nuclear weapons and ending with conventional arsenal, was incredible. The economy was going downhill, but the military-industrial complex was all pervading, and that was not healthy. And it was obvious that there should be cuts made in the military budgets, and the new emphasis put on the refurbishing of the economy rather than strengthening of the military stance and military-industrial complex. It was obvious for Gorbachev, it was not that obvious for the other members of the Politburo, but like I said, as soon as it became dangerous to have unstable political situation in different areas of the country, again, like I mentioned, the strikes and riots and many other things, which are suppressed brutally, but they were there. And the Communist Party could not ignore this and moved Gorbachev forward in doing those peaceful steps. And I think at some point, just like he lost control over Perestroika, he lost control at some point over what journalists are printing, he lost control over what, over the degree he wants to go. He decided to go ahead, he developed a taste for disarming. And he developed a taste for being seen in the West as a liberal personality. I believe I think we should pay tribute in some ways to Margaret Thatcher and François Mitterrand, and I would say Ronald Reagan, in sort of opening him the door to their countries first, and secondly, helping Gorbachev to be perceived in the West as a peacemaking personality, as an open person. And in fact, I believe, strongly believe, that the way they conducted negotiations with him, the way they treated him, the way they opened their countries for him, created the affable, polite, and smiley look of Gorbachev, who somehow individually began to perceive himself as a peace carrier. And I think it was a great. I think we should pay tribute to all those individuals in the Western governments who maybe didn't understood it, but somehow did it, and the reaction from Gorbachev was very very open, very, like I said, very receiving.
When did you first come to the West, Sergei?
I came to the States in 1990, prior being only to Scandinavia, Sweden, and Denmark, where I traveled independently for the first time in my life.
What was that like, you know, going out of Russia freely, independently?
It was not a free travel. It was an assigned travel. And I was, for the first time, I was traveling to the States through Scandinavia. I was obviously sent with a public relations mission from the agency, heading to perform in the States as a sort of a little Gorbachev with all this, with all those friendly statements and all that type of thing. It was, the way I remember, it was a tremendous cultural shock. The shock of not being in Scandinavia, it was in a way very similar to Russia. It was the same European setting. It was clearly, well, same weather, same feeling, same time zone, same, almost everything the same. A little bit more sparkling and, you know, fashionable and cozy in many ways, true. But it was not a great discovery for me because I've seen that before. I would not dare to compare Scandinavia with Indonesia, but you know, here and there you can see the in Indonesia you can see the signs of Western influence and, you know, shopping malls and everything, but it was very similar. The states were the cause of the cultural shock. It was the country which I coveted to see for a long time. I never was able to. A country which I studied as a student, a country from where I had at least four teachers, four Americans who came over to teach me American history through the whole period of Cold War, which was a very rare experience for a Russian person. Needless to say, Moscow State University program in American history was the only program where American Fulbrighters were allowed to teach, and of course on a very limited basis. And having direct contact with those individuals coming in with the books and materials and ready to distribute, ready to be asked and ready to offer help in learning, all that and all that experience of hiding in a forest so that nobody would listen what you're talking to, or going to a barbecue party where you would think there would be no ears eager to absorb and then to spill off to the KGB or something. With all that, coming to U.S. was like meeting a familiar but so different country. Of course, the first trip was was like a blow on all the stereotypes I had, and I remember spending 2 or 3 weeks in a resort area on the way upon my return back and trying to sort things out and understand whether what I saw was a true generalization or a true perfect new set of stereotypes I acquired as a substance for those which I lost while in the States. So it took quite a while to came to a conclusion, certain conclusions on what I saw.
The States, of course, is a very big country, not as big as Russia, but not bad. What parts did you visit when you first came and had that experience?
Well, again, I want to come to this answer from my background. Having worked in Etnovosti, which is, like I said, was a public relations agency for the government, the agency which obviously was manufacturing and selling a lot of propaganda, I was the one of those who were willy-nilly involved in shaping up the propaganda materials for the agency, talking about self-censorship in a way too. Obviously, I developed the stereotypes of the United States, which were imposed on me and by me on the audience we were broadcasting to, or we were offering our materials to. That means that although I realized through simply because I was educated in American history, I mean, I learned a lot and whatever, and whatnot. I had all kinds of experiences with Americans before, and yet I had a lot of these stereotypes which were commonly used in Soviet propaganda, whether you mean racism or subjugation of minorities or unemployment or homelessness or you name it. And I had acquired some of the stereotypes, and I believe I was infected to some extent by them, and I believed in some of them. And you can imagine my astonishment when I came first to the state of Minnesota, which is a almost all white, non-racial state with no problems, which would be similar to which would be experienced in the South states like Mississippi or Alabama, or with no homelessness like New York, with a state which doesn't have many unemployed people like in Los Angeles. Therefore, I found almost like an ideal opposite to the stereotype or set of stereotypes I had. Therefore, it caused a big disturbance, just personal moral disturbance, which, you know, when you're facing things which you thought never existed, and they do. So it took me another two trips to understand that the U.S. is different. There are different corners of the country, different issues, different dialects, different cultures, if you want. But it was not at once. But I'm very grateful to the Minnesota trip because it I dispensed of all the crappy stereotypes I had before. And it was a much more useful trip than I was to Scandinavia, which was almost a disappointment because I expected to see, if not skyscrapers, but an extreme economic development, which I didn't detect there.
Does this mean that your experience in the United States and also your sort of reflection on this, did it change the nature of your reporting? Did it have an effect?
To the great extent. When I came back to Russia after visiting the country about two or three times, when I became assertive of my set of stereotypes I acquired, or my images I acquired, I started to practice different journalism, but I quickly understood that the U.S. is still the country which is considered to be if not an opponent, but the second largest superpower, although friendly one. I still understood that being in an agency like Novosti, I wouldn't be able to practice the journalism I like to practice. Therefore, I had to quit. And I had to leave Novosti for a publication I started, which was primarily a business weekly newspaper. And I believed that I would have much, much more opportunity in expressing myself, my views, in a business for a weekly format rather than in a political or a typical daily newspaper. Since my vision of the U.S. at that time was of a, more of an economic empire rather than a military superpower.
This sort of implies that things were freeing up, the fact that you were able to start a journal, albeit a business journal, but as you say, there's a relationship. Am I right in thinking that, you know, that regarding the press, things were freeing up?
Indeed, they were. They were. They were and they were not, depending on what in what sphere you want to go and what journalism you want to practice. Indeed, there were almost 300 different newspapers appearing in Moscow overnight in 1991. True thing was, though, that none of them were economically self-sufficient. Another problem was that if you are not economically self-sufficient, it means somebody's going to subsidize you. You know, again, whoever pays you is, ordering champagne. So we're getting back to the point where there is a control, indirect, non-political control, but financial rather, and you have to deal with that. And I quickly found out managing the business magazine I had, and I quickly understood that there is no, if you're a sensible person enough, understand there's no way you can go from one extreme to another, which is a very traditional thing for Russia, whether it's politics or economics or anything else. There is no such kind of thing as an authoritarian, totalitarian journalism, and then, the overnight switch to, the anarchist journalism, where you can say and do everything you want. There are limits and to all kinds of journalism freedoms in all the countries in the world.
Even the U.S., you found.
Yeah, sure.